We've made it to the final unit. So just three more chapters. And the first of those for this unit is a chapter about meiosis and sexual life cycles. And we're starting with a pictorial representation of the dichotomy that exists with respect to reproductive modes. There are two major reproductive modes that organisms use. Most use one or the other, not both. There are actually some that can do both. But the two modes are asexual reproduction and sexual reproduction. And each of them has advantages and disadvantages. So it's not really proper to say which one's better. It just depends. But the fundamental difference is that asexual reproduction involves a single parent, which when it produces, or when it reproduces, produces offspring, some number of offspring that are genetically identical to the original, to the parent. For instance, this hydra, which is a protist, is undergoing what's called budding. A new version of itself is really just sprouting out of its side and then will disconnect. On the other hand, sexual reproduction involves two parents, each of which contributes DNA to the offspring. And therefore, in sexual reproduction, however many offspring are produced, those offspring are genetically different from both parents, and they're genetically different from each other. In other words, compared to asexual reproduction, sexual reproduction involves an increase in genetic variation in a population. So, given those definitions, what would be a condition in which asexual reproduction would be advantageous? In other words, when would it be a good thing to make an exact copy of yourself if you're the parent? Well, it is true that that is an advantage. It's just simpler to only involve one parent. But what I was getting at is that if an organism is very well adapted, very well fit, meaning well adapted to the surroundings in which it lives, then why would you want to make any changes? Because if you make a genetically identical offspring, that offspring will be just as well adapted as you are. But there's a problem with that, right, in the long run, which is that no real environment stays constant. Real environments change gradually and sometimes abruptly. So in sexual reproduction, it's a crapshoot. You have no idea what you're going to get. Some offspring might not be as well adapted as you. But because they're all different, and if the environment is changing, it's possible that some of those offspring will be even better adapted. And those will be the ones that will survive, by the way. So, like I said, there's advantages and disadvantages. But for the rest of the chapter, we're going to focus on sexually reproducing species. Using humans as an example in slide 2, but this really would apply to any sexual species. This just happens to be using a human as an example. The black background part of this slide that you see is an example of what's called a karyotype. So this is a human karyotype, but you could make a karyotype for any sexual species. And notice the word karyotype includes the same root as in eukaryotes and prokaryotes, meaning nucleus. It's called a karyotype because it's a picture of what's going on in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. But more specifically than that, this is a photograph at metaphase within this cell. Why would they choose metaphase to take this picture? Which is an arrangement of all the chromosomes found in the nucleus. Why would they want to take that during metaphase? No, before they divide. They divide in anaphase. But the advantage of taking it during metaphase is that they'll never be smaller than they are. That is when the condensing of the chromatin is maximized. So it's easiest to tell them all apart if they're maximally small or compact. So that's when it's taken. But of course, the cell does not pose for this with all these ordered like this. So to form a karyotype is a cut and paste job, which in the old-fashioned sense was literally cut and paste. You take a photograph of the cell and you use scissors to cut out a piece of the photograph for each individual chromosome. You arrange them by size, put them on another piece of paper, and then photograph them again. We do the same thing nowadays. It's just electronic cutting and printing, cutting and pasting. But that's a karyotype. And there, the numbers that you see under these correspond to size. A karyotype is not only an orderly arrangement, it's arranged by size of the chromosomes. And each number denotes a different type of chromosome. So I've told you before that eukaryotes in general have some number of chromosomes, number of different types of chromosomes, and that number just depends on the species. For humans, it's 23 kinds. That's why there are 23 pairs here. But what makes a chromosome a different kind of chromosome compared to another is that different types, which are different numbers here, contain totally different collections of genes, which therefore correspond to totally different collections of proteins and correspondingly characteristics, because proteins give organisms their characteristics. Okay? So that's what makes one different from two, not just its size, but its particular collection of genes. It's important, though, to realize that this cell has two of each type. So when we look at the detail of one, just this one is shown in cartoon form, so it's easier to look at. It's one type of chromosome that we're looking at here. These are both number one chromosomes, but there are two of them. So this is a pair of chromosomes. And each individual chromosome is a replicated chromosome. So each one consists of two identical sister chromatids connected at a centromere. But the number one in the cartoon on the left versus the number one in the cartoon on the right are not identical to each other. They're the same type of chromosome. They're just not identical. Why is it that they are not identical? Or even more basically, why is it that there are two number ones and two number twos and so on? Why do you have two of each of your chromosomes? Well, what's the theme of the slideshow? Right. We are a sexual species. So we get a chromosome of each type from each parent. And therefore, there's two number ones, two number twos, and so on. Since they are the same type, even though they're not identical, and they're not identical because they came from different parents, but since they're the same type, they correspond to each other, and we use a word to describe that, which is homologous. They are homologous chromosomes. And what we see here is one homologous pair. Each of the members of a homologous pair can be called a homolog. So this is one homolog, this is the other homolog. Okay? All right, that's some basic terminology. Let's go to slide 3 and let me give you some more definitions. I need to give you two important definitions that are sometimes confusing when you're first learning them. And I'm assuming probably most of you have not learned these before. They're confusing because they both have to do with numbers of chromosomes, but they mean that they denote totally different things. The first one is just N, which is a symbol. Of course, it's a variable. But it really only varies between species. For any given species, N is a specific number. N, though, always denotes, in genetics, the number of different types of chromosomes that particular species has. So that's why I was saying it's not a variable for an individual species. For humans, it's 23. For corn, it's 40, and so on. It just depends on the species. But N is used as the symbol to denote the number of different kinds of chromosomes in that species. Not necessarily in the cell, but in the species. All right? Now, the other important definition is ploidy. Ploidy is not the same thing as N. Ploidy refers to how many of each kind of chromosome there are in the cell. Okay, so N is how many types there are. Ploidy is how many of each type there are. Like in the previous slide, when we looked at the karyotype, how many were there of each type? No, that's N. There are 23 types. But how many were there of each type? Two. And so we don't say two for the ploidy. If a cell has two of each type, however many there are, then we call that a diploid cell. And the condition would be diploidy. But the adjective is diploid. If, on the other hand, a cell has just one of each type, then it's a haploid cell. And we would call that condition haploidy. So ploidy is a general term that has different degrees to it. And there are more possibilities than just diploid and haploid, but those are the two that I'm going to talk about in this course, and that those are the most often, those are the most frequently occurring kinds of cells. Okay? So if you look at this cartoon of some fictitious species, and you can cheat and look at the words, but just focus on the picture based on the definitions I just told you. What is the N for this species? What's another way of saying what is N? Right. How many types of chromosomes does this species have? No, it's three. Remember, the karyotype was ordered by size. Number one was the biggest, number two was next biggest, and so on. Well, there are three sizes here. Large, medium, and small. That's three types of chromosomes. That's why N is three for the species. Now, for this cell, what is the ploidy? Well, what is that asking? What does it mean to say what is the ploidy? What did I say the definition of ploidy is? No. I mean, that's not enough. How many what? How many oranges? Of chromosome. How many of each type of chromosome are there in this cell? Two. There's two large, there's two mediums, there's two small. Ploidy is how many of each type. Okay? And so this is a diploid cell. We wouldn't say the ploidy is 2. We would say the ploidy is diploid. All right? Now, since N is the number of types, and a haploid cell, by definition, has just one of each of those types, a haploid cell will have N total chromosomes. And that's why we call N, another name for N, is the haploid number. Regardless of how many are in the cell, N is still the haploid number for the species. And 2N is the diploid number, because diploid means having two of each of those N types. Right? Any given cell is either haploid or diploid, since we're confining ourselves to those possibilities. But for the species, N is the haploid number, 2N is the diploid number. And what is about the color here? What's the color represent? Right, in other words, parental origin of these. This cell got the red ones from one parent and the blue ones from the other. In this case, the red came from the mother, the blue from the father. All right, now on to 4. Let's talk about sexual life cycles. We're starting with humans here because we are humans, so it's easiest to think about ourselves first. But really, what I'm going to describe about this applies to all sexual species. We're just using humans as an example. Importantly, though, every sexual species undergoes or has a sexual life cycle that undergoes a generation-to-generation alternation between two important biological processes. And those two processes are shown in the boxes here. So when I mean generation to generation, I'm not talking about over and over within one lifetime. I'm talking about from one generation to the next generation, so on. It goes back and forth, which is what I mean by alternating, between fertilization and then meiosis and then fertilization and then meiosis over and over. So we better define and understand each of these two important processes. I'm going to start with fertilization because it really defines being sexual. What makes a species a sexual species is that it undergoes fertilization. But what specifically is fertilization? It is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one unicellular zygote. So two cells fuse into one, which is kind of the opposite of what usually happens, right? It's usually one cell splitting into two. Now, gamete is a general term. It's a unisex term that means sex cell. But in a sexual species, there are two sexes. Each of them makes its own version of sex cells. Gametes doesn't say which sex. So the male version of gametes, it depends on the species, but for humans and a lot of other organisms, the male version of the gamete is sperm. The female version of the gamete is egg. All right, those are sex cells. When you fuse two gametes to produce one cell, because each gamete by itself is a single cell, when you combine those into one cell, that resulting cell is a zygote. That was the official beginning of you since you were created sexually. But anyway, when that zygote's created, that is what fertilization is. And unless that occurs, you're not really talking about a sexual species. But think about what happens as far as chromosomes are concerned. A gamete has its own chromosomes. It came from one parent. It's a cell from one parent. The other gamete is a cell in its own right that came from the other parent. It has its own chromosomes. When they fuse, the zygote, therefore, has the chromosomes from both gametes. And this, of course, is why offspring are not like either parent, because it's a blending of the two. But it's problematic that the zygote has all of these chromosomes, or it would be problematic. Because what this means is that two gametes, each with their own ploidy, fusing into one zygote, is going to mean that zygote has twice the ploidy that the gametes do, right? In other words, fertilization doubles the ploidy because it combines two sets of chromosomes. Well, that could not, if that were the only thing happening each cycle, there would be quick extinction. It would be impossible. Because it's think about how amazing it is already that we can pack as much DNA as we can into a nucleus within an invisible cell. If you double the amount of DNA every generation, you're only going to get through a couple generations before it becomes just physically impossible. Now, obviously, we haven't gone extinct, and neither have the other sexual species, so there has to be something else to take care of that problem, and that's the other important biological process. That's what meiosis is for. Meiosis accomplishes a halving, or cutting in two, of the ploidy, which therefore undoes the doubling that occurs when fertilization takes place. That way, if you do both, double it and then cut it in half, double it and then cut it in half, you're not building it up over time. It's just double sometimes and then half of that the other time. It doesn't build up. All right, so that's what meiosis is for. That's why it has to be there in a sexual species. So it's not just for humans, for any sexual species, there's an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. Since both of these affect the ploidy, but in opposite ways, fertilization doubles the ploidy, meiosis halves the ploidy. These two boxes are the boundaries between two parts, two halves of the cycle, not necessarily halves, but two parts, with different ploidies. So fertilization gets us to the diploid stage of the cycle. All right? That diploid zygote is the beginning of the diploid part of human life cycle. For any sexual species, there's really two versions of the species. We usually only think of one, but there's two versions of humans. There's a diploid version, which is what we are as adults. There's also a haploid version, which are sperm and eggs. Those are unicellular humans that live their lives as haploid humans. Okay? Now let's broaden the scope. In slide 5, we see three cycles. And the first one is just like the human one we looked at, because it's all animals. Humans are animals, of course. But we have plants in the middle, fungi on the right. Now, those are not the only sexual species. Not all eukaryotes are sexual, but a lot of them are. Of the whole domain eukarya, though, the three biggest groups are animals, plants, and fungi. So that's why this slide focuses on them. But the protists, which are the not... remember, protist means eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. So the protists that are sexual would still have a sexual life cycle like this. Notice what I said is true. What I said earlier is true. Every sexual species has an alternation between these two processes. And so every one of these life cycles features a haploid part of the cycle and a diploid part. But how much time and how many cells are involved in those two parts of the cycle is really what fundamentally differs between these groups. So in animals, and this of course includes humans, the sexual life cycle is dominated by the diploid stage, and it is the only one of the stages for animals that is multicellular. So multicellular humans, which we're examples of, are diploid. Their cells are diploid. We're made of multiple cells, but those cells are diploid cells. Gametes are produced by meiosis, which should make sense because because gametes need to be haploid so that when two gametes get together, you're back to diploid, right? Well, if you are a diploid individual, which we are as adults, then we better make gametes via meiosis, which will cut the ploidy in half. And those gametes then are the unicellular haploid version of humans, or any animal, depending on the species. But for animals, the haploid stage is never multicellular. So, for instance, a sperm, an individual sperm or an egg, a gamete in other words, a couple things can happen. It can live its life as a haploid unicellular human and then die. Or it can meet up with a gamete of the other type in fertilization, which also, though, ends its life, because when the two fuse, you now have a brand new cell called the zygote, which is diploid. Now, that zygote is diploid, but unicellular, of course, at first. When it's created, the zygote is unicellular. But the zygote does not stay as a single cell very long. It quickly undergoes mitosis, which turns the zygote into a two-celled structure, and then four cells and eight cells and so on. That's how we become multicellular, but we are multicellular diploid individuals as animals. Let's look at the other extreme before going to the middle. This is fungi. And they are kind of like the inverse of us because their sexual life cycle is dominated by the haploid phase, which is the only part for them that is multicellular. A fungus, when you think of one fungus, that individual is made of many, many cells, but those cells are haploid. Its body is made out of haploid cells. Okay? Now, if you are haploid, then you're not going to make your gametes via meiosis. In fact, it doesn't even make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis because you can't cut it in half when there's only one of each kind of chromosome. You can't cut the ploidy in half. So they produce their gametes simply by mitosis, making more cells that serve as gametes. Mitosis does not change the ploidy, it just copies the cells. So a gamete from one fungus and a gamete from another fungus get together. That's fertilization, just like it is for us. It produces a diploid zygote, just like it does for us. But unlike us, a diploid zygote as one cell, instead of undergoing mitosis to become a multicellular structure, undergoes meiosis to become haploid cells, each of which is the beginning of a brand new fungal body. Each of those haploid spores then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular, and they live their adult lives as multicellular haploids. See the difference? Well, when we consider plants, which are what are in the middle, it's a little bit like a combination of the two. The sexual life cycle of plants is often given the name alternation of generations. But don't be confused by that, because that use of the word alternation is totally different from what I was talking about. All sexual species undergo alternation between fertilization and meiosis. So that's not what alternation of generations is. What it really specifically refers to, and it's not particularly a good name because it doesn't describe it very well, but it really should be alternation of multicellular generations. It's just too long to say, I guess. But what alternation of generations for plants refers to is the fact that both the haploid stage and the diploid stage feature multicellular forms. And so just like there are two versions of humans, there are two versions of plants, except it's not that one is unicellular only and the other is multicellular. They're both multicellular for plants. And we give special names to them. The haploid generation is called the gametophyte generation. Now, phyte here means plant, and so gametophyte really means gamete-producing plant. They are haploid, multicellular plants, and they produce gametes, since they're haploid, by mitosis, just like a fungus would. Gametes get together to produce a zygote via fertilization. That creates the other version of the species, the diploid version, which becomes multicellular just like we do. So this is the same species, but it looks different because it's the diploid version. And since they are then diploid, they produce spores via meiosis. That's why this diploid stage is called the sporophyte generation. So that's specifically what alternation of generations refers to. Multicellularity in both parts of the, both ploides of this, of the sexual life cycle. All right, now to six. Here we have a cartoon of some species made up. Look at this top cell, though, before anything happens to it. What is the N for this species? No, you're saying there's two different kinds of chromosomes? One. They're the same size. They have the same number of genes and types of genes. So these are the same kind of chromosome. N is one for this species. It's the simplest case, which is why the book chose this, but really it's too simple. It makes it even more confusing. And they should have used an N of two. It would have been better. But this is an N of one. And what about the top cell? What about its ploidy? What is the ploidy?
One.
No?
Two.
No. Diploid. We don't use numbers for ploidy. It's true that there are two of each kind of chromosome, right? There's only one kind, but there are two of them. So this is a diploid cell. It's also a lie. You would not see these as chromosomes, right? Before they're replicated. Because it would just be chromatin. Until you get to the S phase, and then you have twice as much chromatin, and then they condense into something that you would see on the second picture. So this is after the S phase. It's still a diploid cell, but now the two chromosomes, each of the same type, are replicated chromosomes, each consisting of two identical sister chromatids hooked together at a centromere. Okay, now there are multiple differences between meiosis and mitosis. And meiosis is a lot more confusing at first than mitosis is, which is why mitosis is usually taught first. But getting a grasp of meiosis really requires you to have a good understanding of mitosis coming into it, which I hope you do because you've already been tested on that stuff, right? I need you to think back to mitosis, though, and make comparisons as we go along. One big difference between the two, actually, let me start with a commonality. Remember that mitosis is division of the nucleus. It's not the complete cell division. It's just part of cell division, right? It's division of the nucleus. And then you have to have cytokinesis occurring as well if you're going to get two separate cells. That's also true for meiosis. Meiosis is division of the nucleus, but it happens a different way compared to mitosis. But the point is you have to have meiosis and cytokinesis occurring if you're going to have separate cells. Now, one huge difference is that mitosis involves, as you will hopefully remember, a single division event. But meiosis involves two division events, one after another. And therefore, the overall process, which is called meiosis, is broken into meiosis 1 and meiosis 2 with Roman numerals. In a previous slide, I said that the reason that meiosis has to exist, the thing that it accomplishes that's so important, is that it reduces the ploidy. It cuts the ploidy in half, right? So that DNA doesn't build up. Well, that reduction in ploidy occurs in meiosis 1. That's already done by the time you get through with meiosis 1. But we'll talk about why you still have to go on with meiosis 2 even though you've reduced the ploidy, which in a sense is the goal. Okay, now, just picture mitosis. And specifically, even though any ploidy cell can enter mitosis, because mitosis does not mess with ploidy. Whatever it is coming in, you just have two cells that have that same ploidy coming out. It just makes identical, genetically identical copies of a cell. But since we're looking at a diploid cell here for meiosis, picture a diploid cell entering mitosis. What part of mitosis involves lining up halfway between the poles? Right. Metaphase is a subphase of mitosis. Well, meiosis 1 has those same subphases with the same names. Meiosis 2 has those same subphases as mitosis with the same names. But different things are happening. Still, though, in metaphase 1, which is metaphase of meiosis 1, there is a lining up, just like there is in metaphase of mitosis. But picture metaphase of mitosis. What is it that line up in metaphase of mitosis? What gather at the equatorial plane halfway between the poles in mitosis? Yes, chromosomes. That's going to be the answer for all of them, but it's not specific enough. What line up halfway between the poles in metaphase are individual replicated chromosomes. Okay, now we're talking about a diploid cell. So there are two number ones, there are two number twos, and however, what, two of each for N types. But in metaphase, the two number ones don't care where each other are. What I mean by saying that individual replicated chromosomes are lining up is that you have a number one here, a number one somewhere else. You have a number two somewhere, a number two somewhere else. And therefore, the total number of things lining up in metaphase of mitosis for a diploid cell is how many in general? Without even knowing what the species is, what would you say the answer is? You understand what I'm asking here? How many individual replicated chromosomes are in a diploid cell? What does it mean to be diploid? Well, diploid does not mean two. Does not mean having two chromosomes. It means having two of each type. No. How many types does a cell have for a species? N. So if it has two of each of those, how many chromosomes does it have? 2N. That's how many things line up at metaphase of mitosis. Okay? But in meiosis, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up. Instead, it's homologous pairs of chromosomes. Or pairs of homologous chromosomes, you could also say. In other words, unlike metaphase of mitosis, in meiosis, the two number ones do care where each other are. They come together. And they line up as a pair, not as individual replicated chromosomes. The two number twos come together, and they're a second thing. In other words, in a diploid cell for meiosis, one at metaphase, it's N things that line up, not 2N things. And they're not individual replicated chromosomes, they are homologous pairs of chromosomes. Okay? And that's why I was going to say that it would be easier to look at this if this is N of 2. Because what you have lining up here are not two things. What you have lining up here is one pair. These are the poles on the right and the left. The poles aren't up and down. So this is not two things lining up. It's one pair lining up between the poles. Let me just quickly draw what it would look like for an N of 2. Well, in mitosis, you'd have a big and a small, a big and a small. You'd have 2N things lining up, 4 total things. But for meiosis, with an N of 2, you'd have the two big ones coming together, forming a pair for the big type, and the two small ones coming together. Does this make more sense? And you can see, do you understand from this drawing that these are homologous pairs, not individual replicated chromosomes? This mitosis cell has individual replicated chromosomes. Still has the same N, too. But the two number ones are not together, the two number twos are not together. Okay, since different things line up in meiosis 1 versus mitosis, that means the next stage in each of these, which is the division stage, which is anaphase, is also different. In other words, what separates in anaphase of mitosis is different from what separates in anaphase 1 of meiosis. Therefore, think back to mitosis again. What is it that separates during anaphase? You have been tested on this, right? This was on the last test, wasn't it? Had to have been. We just started the unit. Sister chromatids split apart. Two sister chromatids make up a replicated chromosome, which is what's lining up in metaphase. So the chromatids split, which is when we stop calling them chromatids, right? Once they're on their own, they're called daughter chromosomes, and they go to different cells. Well, that's not what splits apart in metaphase 1 of meiosis, because that's not what lines up. Homologous pairs line up, and the homologs that make up that pair separate from each other. Okay? And so appreciate, make sense of this in your mind, that is when the ploidy drops in half. When these sister chromatids in mitosis, go to separate cells, these two cells are still diploid. They just won't have replicated chromosomes anymore, but they'll still have two big ones and two small ones. When these homologous pairs, though, in a cell in meiosis, separate into two homologs that go to different cells, each cell is only going to have one big one and one small one. That means it's already haploid. just like these here, just with the N of 1. This cell is diploid because it has two of the one type of chromosome. Each of these has just one of the one type of chromosome. So these are already haploid cells after meiosis 1. And that's the part of meiosis that has to be accomplished, the reduction in ploidy, so that you can undergo fertilization without building it up. But why aren't we done? Why do we need meiosis 2? What's the problem with these intermediate cells after meiosis 1 compared to two cells that mitosis produces? What's different about them? What's different about their chromosomes? Well, let's draw what this one would split into. One cell is going to have those. The other one is going to have the same thing. What's different about these chromosomes compared to these chromosomes in the slide? They're what? What are separated? They're not. Not only did they separate, they're now in separate cells. But how would you describe this one chromosome to distinguish it from this one chromosome? What's different fundamentally? This is a replicated chromosome. That's not. That's why you have to have division of the chromatids in mitosis so that you only have enough DNA for one cell. Right? These are not replicated chromosomes. These are. You see the difference in the pictures? Are you not seeing this? Or do you? Okay, so one person sees it. Does everyone else see it? These are replicated. These are not replicated.
Can you tell that they're replicated?
Yeah, they're made up of two sister chromatids. This is not two sister chromatids. This is just one unreplicated chromosome. Well, this one in the meiosis 1 is not unreplicated. It's still replicated. It still has twice as much DNA as a single cell needs because it's still made of two sister chromatids hooked together. Therefore, even though we have accomplished the reduction in ploidy, we still have to undergo another round of division to separate the two chromatids from each other so that there will be only enough DNA for a single cell. In other words, meiosis 2 has to do the same thing that mitosis does. And really, meiosis 2 is exactly like mitosis. It just starts with each of the two cells that meiosis 1 spits out. So you can see that this one replicated chromosome becomes two cells with unreplicated chromosomes. And the same thing for the red one. Since there are two division events in meiosis, that means the ultimate product is four cells, not two. And importantly, they are genetically different from the original cell, of course, because the ploidy is different for one thing. And they're not genetically identical to each other, like the cells that mitosis produces are. Okay, we're going to review this again with different picture now in slide 7. So hopefully it'll stick better. Here we see the important individual stages. Like I said, they're named the same way they are in mitosis. We're skipping pro-metaphase, but it's really there. Now, when we look at this cell, whatever species this represents, what is the N here? Yes, it's an N of 3. And it's what, a haploid or a diploid? It's a diploid cell. It doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis. You can't cut the ploidy in half when there's only one of each type. Right? You have to have two of each type to cut it in half. So yes, this is an N of 3, but it's a 2N cell. It's a diploid cell. I need to introduce the fact that sexual reproduction for a species, mixes things up genetically. Because of sex, there's a lot more genetic variation among individuals, or between individuals, than without sex. All right? But it's not really that sex creates the variation. It just amplifies it. What I mean by that is that the only reason sex leads to greater genetic variation is because there is genetic variation to begin with. It's a lot like shuffling a deck of cards to randomize things. But if you have a deck of cards that's nothing but 11 of hearts, shuffling them does not make a damn bit of difference, right? Everyone's going to get a hand of nothing but 11 of hearts. So what I'm saying here is that the only reason sex works is because something else caused actual genetic variation to begin with. What is it that is the original source of all genetic variation? In other words, why is it that we are not simply genetic copies of the first cell that gave rise to all organisms? What happens that causes new sequences of DNA to appear? We've talked about it. Mutation. Mutation is the original source of all genetic variation. If you didn't have mutation, all organisms would be identical and sex wouldn't do a damn thing. It would just be a more complicated way of producing offspring compared to asexual reproduction. But since there is variation, sex takes that variation and amplifies it by shuffling the deck, so to speak. And there are three sources of additional variation that sex adds. I'll give them to you in the order in which they occur. I'll just name them first, but I'll explain them as I go. The first source of additional variation is what is called crossing over. The second is called independent assortment. And the third is called random fertilization. Now, these first two of the three, crossing over first and then independent assortment, occur before fertilization. They occur simply in each parent during meiosis. They are part of meiosis. And the first of those, which is crossing over, occurs right away in the first subphase of meiosis, which is prophase 1, or prophase of meiosis 1, same thing. So I want you to picture mitosis as we look at this meiosis prophase to appreciate the difference. If you consider a diploid cell with an N of 3, so it's two number 1s, two number 2s, two number 3s, in prophase of mitosis, the two number 1s don't care where the other one is, right? But look what's happening here in prophase 1 of meiosis. The two number 1s find each other, the two number 2s find each other, the two number 3s find each other, and they come together. that coming together process of homologous chromosomes is called synapsis. And so synapsis is what forms homologous pairs. Well, I shouldn't say it that way. They're homologous pairs even before they come together. But when they do synapse, we can give it, we can still call them a homologous pair, but when they're together, we can give them another name, which is tetrad. Now, tetrad is a real general word, really, that just means a four-part thing, right? Tetra means four. The reason that a pair is called a tetrad is because these are replicated chromosomes, right? Each one consists of two sister chromatids. So in terms of chromatids, one pair of replicated chromosomes consists of four overall chromatids. That's why it's called a tetrad. Okay, now, that is an important part of prophase one, synapsis. But it's not simply that they synapse. Also, even though they don't have to, they usually do crossing over after synapsis. And we'll get a better view of crossing over later, but crossing over is a pretty good description because you have one chromatid from one homolog, and a non-sister chromatid, it's non-sister because it's on the other homolog, in other words, one red one and one blue one, will cross over at some point along their length, which is why it's called crossing over. The actual crossover point, and there can be more than one, is called a chiasma, which means cross, and that's the singular. Chiasmata is the plural of that word. Well, the crossing over really doesn't do anything, except that when they do cross over, whatever is downstream of that chiasma, from there all the way to the tip, each non-sister chromatid will swap that DNA sequence with the other non-sister chromatid. Red for blue, blue for red, which you see right here. Well, actually, you don't see it very well there, but this one, notice, that is partly blue and the rest red, and the other one is partly red and the rest blue because of crossing over. So notice that right away, as soon as that happens, you have a chromosome that has never existed in nature before. It is a sequence of DNA that has never existed because it's partly from one individual and partly from the other, the two parents. It's not like either parent. All right, now, of the three sources of additional variation that I've given you, they're all important, but crossing over, this first one, really accounts for the vast, vast majority because simply of how many ways this can happen. Keep in mind that a chromosome is millions of nucleotides long. And it crossing over can effectively happen just about anywhere along that length. Which means if you think about the number of possible ways that can happen, it would be roughly 2 to the however many million of nucleotides there are. To the millionth power. 2 to the millionth power is practically infinity. I mean, the total number of atoms in the universe, which I assume you realize is a big number, right? Have any idea what that number is? It's roughly 10 to the 50th power. I don't know what it would be for 2 to... But 2 to the millionth power, that blows away the number of atoms in the universe. Number of atoms in the universe would be tiny compared to that number. And that's just for one chromosome. You would then have to multiply that by all the other chromosomes happening. And it can happen more than once in one chromosome. So this is why, just for crossing over alone, this is why you could have a different child every day for a billion years with the same parents. and you would still never get two that are genetically identical because there's just so many possibilities. So that's the richest source of additional variation. But then let's look at metaphase one. That's when the lining up occurs, but remember, it's not the same as what's lining up in metaphase, in meiosis, and mitosis. Mitosis, there would be six things lining up. Each individual replicated chromosome would be lining up. Here you have three, or N, homologous pairs, or three tetrads. Tetrads are what line up during metaphase one of meiosis. All right? Well, this brings us to the second source of genetic variation, which, as I said, was called independent assortment. Well, study the phrase. The assortment word by itself in this sense, in the genetic sense, assortment refers to how one tetrad, one pair, lines up during metaphase. Remember, a tetrad in the cartoon version is a blue and a red together, right? It's like a coin. There's a head and a tail. So there's, for that one tetrad, there's two ways it could line up. Either red up, blue down, or blue up, red down. It's like flipping a coin. So that's what assortment by itself means. The overall phrase, though, independent assortment, refers to the fact that how one tetrad lines up is not at all affected by how the other tetrads line up. They're all independent of each other. In other words, each tetrad is flipping its own coin to determine how it lines up. If there were not independent assortment, then they would all be either blue up and red down, or all red up and all blue down. Now that's possible, but you'd have to do that by flipping three heads, right? Or three tails. But if you flip a head and two tails, then you have what's shown here. Two of them are red up and blue down, the other one's blue up and red down, because each one assorts independently. Well, that, since these are going to, after they split, these are going to go to different cells, it matters how they line up, because red is not genetically identical to blue. Therefore, those cells will get one version or the other. So independent assortment just by itself is another source of variation. Assuming you have an N of two or more. If there's an N of one, it doesn't really matter. One cell is going to get the red one, the other cell is going to get the blue one. But as soon as you have two or more, then there's multiple possibilities. And if the N is 2, then you have two possibilities. Either one will get both blues, one will get both reds, or one will get a red and a blue, and the other will get a blue and a red. Okay? But since there's two possibilities for each additional tetrad, that means every time you N goes up by 1, you double the number of possibilities. And in general, the number of possibilities due just to independent assortment is 2 to the n minus 1. Notice that for n equals 1, n minus 1 would be 0. 2 to the 0 is just one possibility. It doesn't really matter. But for humans, n is 23. So 2 to the n minus 1 would be 2 to the 22nd power, which I think is like 8 million, something like that. Seems like a big number, and it is a lot of possibilities, but it's practically zero compared to the number of crossing over possibilities. Thing is, though, this almost infinite number of possibilities that you have just from the first source, crossing over, then gets multiplied by 8 million, making it even more ridiculous. More ridiculously huge. Okay. While I'm still at these additional sources of variation, let me just explain what the third source is. That was random fertilization. Each parent is making its own gametes, right? And so you can think of the number of possible gametes that each parent can make as a huge deck of cards, almost infinite number of cards in each deck. Each parent has an equally huge deck of cards. Random fertilization refers to randomly taking a gamete from one parent and randomly taking a gamete from the other parent and getting those two particular gametes together, which is like drawing one card from each nearly infinite deck. And therefore, the number of possible zygotes that can be produced by those two same parents is almost infinity times almost infinity squared, which is why you're never going to have identical twins unless an accident happens. In identical twins, it was supposed to be one human. It's one zygote, was supposed to develop into one embryo, but accidentally it split into two cells that were now two individual zygotes that are genetically identical. And those then become multicellular independently. But if a woman drops two eggs and they both get fertilized by different sperm, they're going to be totally different genetically, just like brother and sister born 6 years apart would be. Okay, now, that anaphase, when the homologs of the tetrads split from each other, that's when the ploidy reduces. So each of these two cells that are the product of meiosis one is already haploid because each one of them has only one of the three types of chromosomes. But notice that these are still replicated chromosomes because we didn't split chromatids, we split homologs from each other. That's why you're not done yet and you have to go through another round, which is just like mitosis. Meiosis two simply lines things up and splits the chromatids from each other, just like mitosis does. And that will give you just enough DNA for a single cell, because this cell will become two, this other cell will become two, for a total of four. And all four of those cells are genetically distinct from each other. They're genetically distinct from the original cell. And the next time this happens in another cell from that same parent, four totally different ones will come up. That's what I mean by the number of possibilities being nearly infinite. A male human produces millions of sperm every day for decades and doesn't come close to ever once producing the same sperm twice. All right, now, before I talk about eight, I want to tell you that there are two types of cells in your body. And those are called somatic cells. And germline cells. Now, somatic is a word that means of the body. Soma means body. And it's kind of a misnomer because, of course, the germline cells are also part of your body. But the reason somatic was used here is that of your roughly 100 trillion cells that make up your body, almost all of them are somatic cells. That is really the stuff of your body. A tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of your overall cells are germline cells. Although they're different categories, they have the same ploidy. Your somatic cells are diploid. Your germline cells are diploid. What's different is the kind of cell division that these cells can undergo. Somatic cells can undergo mitosis only. Mitosis and cytokinesis, but as far as nuclear division, only mitosis. So somatic cells can either die or become two new cells. Germline cells are found only in gonads, which is another general or unisex term. A gonad is the primary sex organ. What makes an organ a primary sex organ is it's the organ that's responsible for making the gametes, the sex cells. So, for us, the male version of gonads are the testes, and the female version of gonads are the ovaries. But anyway, that's where you find this tiny collection of cells called germline cells. They're diploid just like somatic cells are, but germline cells undergo mitosis and meiosis. Not just meiosis. And here's why. If you have a tiny population of cells, every time one of those undergoes meiosis, it no longer exists, right? When a cell splits it, the original cell is no longer there. So that would mean if all it did was meiosis, you would be depleting that already small population and you'd run out quickly. So that small population is maintained because when one cell is spurred into cell division, it will undergo mitosis first. The original cell is no longer there, but now there are two identical ones. One will just hang around and replace the one that was lost, and the other one will go on to meiosis so that you never run out of that small population of germline cells. Now, 8 compares mitosis and meiosis. We've already talked about this, but one thing this doesn't show, and I've mentioned this before, is that mitosis doesn't require a diploid cell to start with. Any ploidy of cell can enter mitosis because mitosis simply makes duplicates, doesn't change the ploidy. But we're seeing a diploid cell entering here with an N of 3. And remember, there's only one division event, and therefore one lining up event. But what lines up in a diploid cell are 2N individual replicated chromosomes. Meiosis requires a diploid cell. Haploid cell entering meiosis doesn't make sense. And there's 2 lining up events. Metaphase 1 lines up tetrads, which are formed because synapsis occurs, unlike mitosis, synapsis and crossing over. The homologs of the tetrads split apart in anaphase 1. That reduces the ploidy, but they're still replicated chromosomes, so you have meiosis 2 to line up the replicated chromosomes and split the chromatids into daughter chromosomes. So you produce genetically distinct 4 genetically distinct cells. Every time this occurs, they'll be genetically different from the ones that came before. Well, 9 is another summary, but just in words, and I've gone through this, so I'm not going to read it to you, but it's important stuff. In 10, for some reason, this I wish that this book had done this in the previous order, and I had never noticed it, but I didn't want to change the slideshow after I'd already recorded it. What this is showing you is independent assortment. And what I was bitching about is that independent assortment happens after crossing over, not before. But this is showing you the slide before it shows you the slide for crossing over. It's reversed in time. But notice here, you have to have at least an N of 2, like I was saying. It wouldn't matter with an N of 1. But here's possibility 1, here's possibility 2. That's the only 2 possibilities for an N of 2, because 2 to the 2 minus 1 is 2 to the 1, which is 2 possibilities. If you had 3, though, there would be 2 times 2 possibilities, or 4 possibilities. And for us, it's 2 to the 22nd power. But just that by itself, assuming that crossing over doesn't occur, which it really would, just this independent assortment itself leads to new combinations. 11, though, is a representation of crossing over, which happens actually before the previous slide. And this is the one that really has unlimited number of possibilities. You can see that each partially blue and partially red chromosome is one that has never existed in nature before because it comes from 2 different people. And I think that might be it. Yep, good timing.